Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Silvercrest Asset Management Group's first quarter 2019 earnings call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question and answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your telephone keypad. As a reminder, today's conference is being recorded. Before we begin, let me remind you that during today's call, Silvercrest will make forward-looking statements pursuant to the safe harbor provisions of the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. All statements other than the statements of historical fact, including statements regarding future events and developments in Silvercrest's future performance, as well as management's current expectations, beliefs, plans, estimates, or projections relating to the future are forward-looking statements. These forward-looking statements are only predictions based on current expectations and projections about future events. These forward-looking statements are subject to a number of risks and uncertainties, and there are important factors that could cause actual results, level of activity, performance, or achievements to differ materially the statements made. Among these factors are fluctuations in quarterly and annual results, incurrence of net losses, adverse effects of management focusing on implementation of growth strategy, failure to develop and maintain the Silvercrest brand, and other factors disclosed in the company's filings with the SEC, including those factors listed under the caption entitled Risk Factors in the company's annual report on Form 10-K for the year ended December 31st, 2018, filed with the SEC. In some cases, these statements can be identified by forward-looking words such as believe, expect, anticipate, plan, estimate, likely, may, will, could, continue, project, predict, goal, the negative or plural of these words, and other similar expressions. These forward-looking statements are predictions based on Silvercrest's current expectations and its projections about future events. All forward-looking statements made on this call are made as of the date hereof, and Silvercrest assumes no obligation to update these forward-looking statements. I would now like to turn the call over to Rick Hough, Chairman and CEO of Silvercrest. Sir, you may begin.
Great. Thank you very much, and thanks for joining us for the first quarter of 2019 results for Silvercrest Asset Management. After finishing 2018 with record calendar year revenue and following a sustained multi-year period of organic growth, Silvercrest experienced a difficult first quarter of 2019, primarily as a result of revenue recorded after the equity market's fourth quarter sell-off and negative asset flows. The markets have since rebounded, and the firm ended the first quarter of 2019 with $15.3 billion in discretionary assets under management, which is up $1.1 billion during the quarter, and $20.8 billion in total assets under management, up $1.8 billion from the end of the fourth quarter. Silvercrest has recently invested in a number of initiatives which we expect to drive our future growth. During the first quarter of 2019, Silvercrest announced the acquisition of an international equity strategy being incubated at the firm, and we have completed integration of that business. More recently, Silvercrest announced one of its most significant acquisitions in the history of the company. We have agreed to acquire substantially all of the assets of Cortina Asset Management, LLC, a highly regarded growth investment management firm with nearly $2 billion in institutional assets. We expect to close on that transaction in the third quarter of 2019. We have long sought the right partner to establish an innovative and high-caliber growth equity capability at the firm, and this is a good example of how we seek to combine strong intellectual capital within a supportive partnership to benefit our institutional and individual investors alike. We're excited to support Cortina's special talent and enhance their strategies in the marketplace, setting the stage for our next phase of growth. Meanwhile, we're seeing substantial institutional interest in Silvercrest's multiple existing value equity strategies, some of which have only recently been introduced to the marketplace. The years 2019 and 2020 will be important for realizing the fruits of Silvercrest's OCIO initiative, or Outsourced CIO Initiative, which is an investment we completed at the end of the third quarter of 2018, building our business development team. Silvercrest also laid the groundwork for future growth in the high net worth business. We've supported new junior and senior portfolio managers, and we plan to continue building those ranks during 2019. We also have now introduced our value-added family business advisory capability. which helps businesses with succession planning, restructuring, recapitalizations, and sales, and which in time should help us attract new wealth management opportunities. While the current M&A environment for wealth management firms does remain expensive, Silvercrest continues to actively evaluate selective and prudent acquisitions with culturally compatible firms to complement our organic growth, including the potential to expand into new geographies. Meanwhile, we will seek value on behalf of shareholders where opportunity resides, and we will continue to foster initiatives to organically grow the firm. On April 30th, the company's board of directors declared a quarterly dividend of 15 cents per share of Class A common stock. That dividend will be paid on or about June 21st, 2019, to shareholders of record as of the close of business on June 14th, 2019. Scott Gerard will now go over our financials following those introductory remarks, and then I'll be available for questions.
Great. Thanks, Rick. So as disclosed in our earnings release for the first quarter, discretionary AUM as of March 31st, 2019 was $15.3 billion, and total AUM as of the same date was $20.8 billion. Revenue for the quarter was $22.6 million, and reported consolidated net income for the quarter was $3 million. So the revenue for the first quarter represented approximately a 7% decrease over revenue of approximately $24.3 million for the same period last year. This decrease was driven primarily by the market sell-off during the fourth quarter of last year and net client outflows in discretionary AUM. Expenses for the first quarter were $18.6 million, representing approximately a 2% decrease from expenses of $19 million for the same period last year. This decrease was primarily attributable to a decrease in compensation expense of $0.9 million, partially offset by an increase in G&A expenses of approximately $0.5 million. Compensation expense decreased primarily because of a decrease in the accrual for bonuses, partially offset by increased salary expense as a result of merit-based increases and newly hired staff. The increase in general and administrative expenses during the first quarter as compared to the same period last year was primarily due to increases in portfolio and systems expenses due to an increase in soft dollar-related research costs and an increase in occupancy and related costs as a result of the adoption of the new lease accounting standard effective January 1st of this year. Reported consolidated net income was $3 million for the quarter as compared to $4.1 million in the same period last year. Reported net income attributable to Silvercrest or the Class A shareholders for the first quarter of 2019 was approximately $1.7 million or 20 cents per basic and diluted Class A share. Adjusted EBITDA, which we define as EBITDA without giving effect to equity-based compensation expense and non-core, non-recurring items, was approximately $5.8 million or 25.5% of revenue for the quarter, compared to $6.9 million or 28.5% of revenue for the same period last year. Adjusted net income, which we define as net income without giving effect to non-core and non-recurring items, and income tax expense, assuming a corporate rate of 26%, was approximately $3.3 million for the quarter, or 24 cents per basic adjusted and adjusted diluted earnings per share. Adjusted earnings per share is equal to adjusted net income divided by the actual Class A and Class B shares outstanding as of the end of the reporting period for basic adjusted EPS, and to the extent dilutive, we add unvested restricted stock units and non-qualified stock options to the total shares outstanding to compute diluted adjusted EPS. Looking at the balance sheet, total assets were approximately $146.5 million as of March 31st, 2019. This compared to $133.4 million as of the end of last year. Cash and cash equivalents were approximately $45.5 million at March 31st of this year compared to $69.3 million at the end of last year. As a result of the adoption of the new lease accounting standard that went into effect January 1st of this year, certain lease commitments now appear on the statement of financial condition as operating and finance lease assets and liabilities. As of March 31st, 2019, Our operating and finance lease assets and liabilities totaled $36.3 million and $43 million, respectively. Total Class A stockholders' equity was approximately $56.6 million at March 31st of this year. That concludes my remarks. I'll now turn it over to Rick for Q&A.
Great. Thank you very much, Scott. We're available at this time for questions from our shareholders. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star and the number one key on your telephone keypad. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. To prevent any background noise, we ask you please place your line on mute once your question has been stated. And our first question comes from Sumeet Mody with Sandler O'Neill. Your line is open.
Hey, good morning, guys. How are you?
Good morning.
Good morning.
So first one, I got a few questions, but the first here on Cortina, just can you talk a little bit about the acquisition, how they slot into the franchise, and then secondly, kind of how long was the deal in the works, and, you know, talk a little bit about the genesis of the transaction a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll just start with a simple question. It was in the works for months. I don't even remember when. Sometime in the middle of last year, maybe the beginning of the third quarter, something like that. I could be off by a month or two. You know, in a business when you're acquiring the assets of that are the result of really good intellectual capital and hard work in a partnership culture, and they have a special culture, the due diligence on their side and on ours it takes a very long period of time. If one of the most important things that you both as mutual firms coming together care about are cultural compatibility and working together in a partnership and kind of understanding how you're going to grow and work together. So, you know, it was a long period of time. I think Silvercrest is going to be, at least on our side, and I know that I can speak on behalf of what will be my new partners, getting that chemistry right and really understanding the path forward and how we can make something work and feel really confident in each other's skills and build a high level of trust takes time. We've never engaged in pure financial engineering or doing deals merely for the purposes of growing our revenue and showing a good number. What we're doing is trying to implement a long-term strategy. So it took a fair bit of time, and I think from the point when we knew we were going to do something together, even to being able to announce something, took 3 months or so, maybe four. So we were both very, very careful, but it was primarily oriented around understanding who we are, trusting each other, getting to know our cultures, and really understanding a vision for growing in the future. So that was your first question. It touched on some important things, I think, for us and our firm. In terms of our strategy, you know, Silvercrest has long had this wonderful tradition of value equity and core value led by our analyst team here. We've grown the institutional business very substantially over the past few years, primarily by bringing small cap to the marketplace. And we can talk about it further, but we now have new capabilities in the marketplace that are gaining some traction. And it's been a key differentiator for us to be an asset management firm, as you would surmise from our name, Silvercrest Asset Management. It's not just wealth management. We are offering institutional quality capabilities to our high net worth audience, and we're doing so in a conflict-free environment in a way that makes it highly, highly competitive against our open architecture competitors because we're avoiding a double layer of fees. So, you know, there's an incredible symbiotic relationship between having the high net worth base business and the ballast that provides and being able to argue that our clients are getting institutional quality capabilities and then underwriting and supporting that ability by bringing those institutional capabilities to the marketplace. Well, there are a lot of asset classes, right? There's international, there's growth, there's different kinds of credit, et cetera. And while we don't have to do everything, it's sort of a no-brainer, and it has been for a long time, that we complement a really high-quality value strategy with a great equity team that's managing growth. And in Cortina, we found them. It took a really long time. It's something that's been on our radar screen for well over a decade. but you had to find the right people at the right time with an appropriate growth vision. And that's what we found in Cortina. The marketplace was also conducive to Silvercrest working with an institutional manager and coming into the fold. You know, if you went back several years ago, someone like Cortina and the high-quality team they have there would naturally, in many cases, have looked to a large bank or brokerage firm where they could be plugged into products, clients shoved into the portfolios, and grow that way. Well, with the rise in passive over the past several years, with banks and brokerages going through their own issues on how to handle active management, with a plethora of product that were overlapping, that was no longer necessarily a winning formula. And for certain firms, working in that environment isn't that appealing. And more and more recently, over the past couple of years, 3 years, we have been talking to asset management firms in the institutional business about growth or something else. And we were viewed as a much more viable alternative, a partnership culture that was highly supportive, a place where the capability would be unique and a real differentiator and a real needle mover at the firm that they'd be coming to. With a sound marketing plan, with high quality institutional contacts among consultants and others. So, you know, there was a real opportunity for us, especially at a time that you've seen wealth management firms continue to be quite frothy in the marketplace. And asset managers, if you look at the large, certainly if you look at the large publicly traded asset managers, sort of being discounted by the market and not being taken as seriously as they used to be due to some of the threats in the business, whether it was fee compression or passive or something else. So the stars aligned, we got what we needed, and we were very patient in thinking about how we were going to deploy that capital with partners we really, really feel strongly about.
Thanks. That was really helpful, actually. Answered a couple of my questions. But another one, just as a follow-up, it was kind of a nicely sized acquisition. I heard you guys talk about, you know, not wanting to do acquisitions or any kind of financial engineering, but how much of a factor was the size in this transaction, and was that kind of a part of the consideration at the outset, or?
The real consideration about, so it is, the largest in terms of nominal value that Silvercrest has done. And I think probably on a percentage value to the overall value of the company. So size, if anything, gives us a bit of pause, right? That just raises the stakes about what you're doing. And some of what I was referring to before in my prior answer is just really being certain that these are the people you want to be long-term partners with, and this is capital that is going to be accretive to shareholders in a good way, a meaningful way, if we were to go forward with the deal. So, yeah, you're looking at the financials and what it means to the company and how it's going to contribute to earnings per share, to EBITDA, and general accretion. That goes without saying, and that's what we've done in the past. But the stakes in terms of just making sure this is right are higher. So if anything, it slows me down a bit. We're excited. Sure, here's a growth management capability we've been looking for. We have a lot of Midwestern clients. That's kind of nice that they're in the Midwest. The intellectual capital can really be anywhere. We happen to like Milwaukee and the people there. We love Midwesterners, so that's all great. But it was really about making sure we were confident that this would be a benefit to my partners who are also shareholders, because when you deploy this much capital on behalf of a company on our side, you really have to make sure it's right.
Okay, great, thanks. And then you know, maybe more broadly, with sort of the core Silvercrest, can you provide a little color on the search environment, how pipelines are looking on the institutional side at the moment?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked, because if you recall at the end of the fourth quarter when I did that call, I felt that, excuse me, I have allergies. I need to cough a moment. Please excuse me. Thank you. You may recall that the pipeline with the market decline in the fourth quarter, I felt really, really slowed up. I mentioned that in the extended Q&A that we had. And not surprisingly, with the market rebound in the first quarter and continuing to date, our pipeline has really blossomed is the only word I can use. It is substantially higher than it was at quarter end in the fourth quarter, on the order of 4 or 5 times as much potential new business as we had at the end of the fourth quarter. To give you magnitude, I won't give you numbers, but that just gives you an idea of how much sentiment has changed. What I like, and by the way, that pipeline I've always defined here with my marketing colleagues is invite-only RFPs, a semi-finalist or a finalist candidate to be completed in the next 6 months. So this is very real stuff. This isn't just us going out with an RFP or, you know, blindly answering calls for folks to submit their RFPs. These are things where we've been clearly invited or that we're a semi-finalist or finalist candidate. Not only has that blossomed with the increase in the markets, but as you know, it's the small cap capability that we first brought to the marketplace. And by the way, with Cortina, that's what we're really going to be working with on them is their small cap expertise, capacity constrained product that has some real viability in the marketplace, and then we move on from there. We are now in several SMID searches, which, as you know, we've been promoting. That was the next logical thing to do. But what's really heartening is that we have several large cap and equity income searches that are in progress. That's a really nice indicator to us for a couple of reasons. One is I have not been shy in talking about the fact that in many respects, while passive has been an incredible boon to retail investors and many others for efficiency in the marketplace, that it has a role to play, but that I felt in many respects there have been issues with passive and that active was going to be coming back to the fore, and that I believed it was very important to have extremely high quality, fundamental, bottom-up active management. The fact that professional institutional investors are now looking at spaces that used to be considered something that you would just go to passive for, like large cap, is an indicator that we may be right about that thesis. You have to remain humble and question whether you are at all times. Maybe even be paranoid a bit about how you're going to grow, especially in as competitive as space is active. But I'm looking at that phenomenon very carefully because it's a fairly new one. It's a trend we noticed, a year ago to 6 months ago, but it's moved substantially in that direction over the most recent quarter.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And then I guess shifting over to the OCIO business,
Can
you maybe talk about the progress of the build out there, and then secondly, just the overall expansion, the effect the expansion is having on kind of managing costs on the comp and non-comp side as well.
Yeah. Okay. So let me talk about progress in hiring. We're done with hiring. We made our last hire for that team on the business development side at the very end of the third quarter, I think at the fourth quarter of last year. So that does mean that the comp that we have taken on in order to support that initiative will have a full year this year. It was only a quarter or two, depending on who you look at, of those hires. A lot of the build-out for the intellectual capital of the nuts and bolts of the team have occurred progressively as their own business grew, serving other RIAs with their asset allocation, risk management, and manager due diligence work, family offices that had investment professionals and wanted to hire us. Even some large banks have hired us for some work. And so a lot of the build of that team was covered by their own revenue coming in. So really didn't hit the P&L in a meaningful way, maybe a little bit on the comp side. The new hires we took on more recently, that business, you know, is to come, so is a hit against comp. However, I will note that we've always talked about a compensation goal at the company for 55% of revenue. We came in under 55% for 2018. Certainly, if the market sell-off had been sustained, there's a potential we could have exceeded that. However, a lot of compensation at the firm is also driven formulaically and is tied to revenue, so that would have come down as well. So on the, it didn't really touch the P&L. Remains to be seen for this year. I could work it out, but I think it's a rounding error, quite frankly. We were basically adding a person and a half since we last talked. In terms of hard costs, there really hasn't been much in the way to speak of there. The systems research is required to manage our high net worth business. It's a shared pool of capital, not unlike when our high net worth clients need access to or use our equity capabilities. There's a set cost for providing that. So again, not really a noticeable cost on that side. In general, there's been a trend to have to pay more hard dollars for research. There are regulatory issues that are more expensive, regardless of whether we have OCIO or not. That's just a reality for even our equity capabilities at the firm. So, you know, 2019 and 20 are going to be very important for whether that growth initiative is going to show results. The nice thing about it, there's some pretty good leverage associated with it because of the cost basis. And, you know, if it doesn't work, well, we'll move on. We still need a lot of the intellectual capability and work for the high net worth audience that's already here and that we're paying for. And there's already an embedded business serving other institutions. It's just not strictly OCIO. OCIO, if you will, is additional growth on top of the infrastructure we have.
Okay, great. Thanks. And then just last one from me. Can you expand a little bit about the family, you know, business advisory capability you discussed in your prepared remarks and in the press release?
Yeah, I just wanted to highlight it because it is important that we continue to focus on growing the high net worth business organically. The RIA business at large is fast growing. But if you look at individual firms, individual RIAs working with wealth management clients at the company level, after they've started, maybe a breakaway broker or a private banker start a new firm, after a few years, the organic growth really slows. And, you know, I would argue that the average firm is probably close to being just under 2% organic growth. And we've done a pretty good job of exceeding that at the firm, but we have to continue recruiting portfolio managers, which I also mentioned in my introductory remarks, which we are going to do. We added a new portfolio manager at the end of the third quarter, beginning of the fourth quarter last year. I see myself adding more this year who can bring business to the firm. But you also need to be able to get in front of clients who have any number of barriers in front of them. And it's a relationship and referral business. So we hired a gentleman to provide the services you just mentioned, succession planning, recapitalizations, sales, a family business and what have you, as a fiduciary on their side of the table. And the revenue from those activities will support his efforts here. Just to be clear, I don't expect the revenue from that activity at the firm to be a big needle mover. It really is about having a value-added services as part of our family office offering, either to existing clients who have illiquid wealth in those situations, or to new families that would be highly desirable for us to meet, and which would help grow new high net worth assets and revenue. So it's the secondary and ancillary effects of having that service that I'm primarily interested in.
Okay, great. Thanks for taking all my questions.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome. Sure thing. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. And our following question comes from Ernie Ersener of The Private Investor. Your line is open.
Hi, good morning. Couple of quick questions. Your 2019 CapEx expenditure and D&A expenditure level, please, 2019.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Your 2019 CapEx and D&A
yep.
levels for 2019, please.
Yeah, so our CapEx, for this year, we have renovations going on in our corporate headquarters, so we'll have, we'll have a higher than normal level of CapEx this year as we build out those leasehold improvements. As a result of that, our depreciation and amortization, will go up as well, as those are amortized over the balance of our lease, which is for another, roughly 8 years left on our lease here in New York.
Okay, you don't have a specific level of CapEx?
No, I don't.
Intend to use?
Not a specific level. It's fluid now as we're going through construction.
Okay, most of my questions on OCIO were answered, but could you comment at the end of 2019, assuming it meets your expectations, how its margins would compare with your core business?
Its margins are a little better than the core business because those relationships are institutional. When you're dealing with endowments and foundations, there is a lot more leverage like you would find with an equity team. So as that grows, we would expect it to be additive to either EBITDA or earnings margins. But as we've said, we've just built out the team. It's quasi-relationship oriented, so you do need a little more personnel than you do in a pure equity management institutional relationship. So it kind of resides on a margin basis in between high net worth and pure institutional business. Pure institutional business, as you know, can have extremely high margins. High net worth business, depending on the complexity of the case, can be anywhere from the mid to high teens at least a lot of the firms I look at, to the low to mid 20s. Obviously, we're pushed up a bit higher because of our own institutional business. But on a margin basis, to answer your question, it's a little bit more expansive.
Okay. On the Cortina acquisition, do you have either any performance-based compensation criteria built into the agreement? And will they be getting any shares versus cash?
Yes, they will. So the answer to your first question, there is performance criteria in their compensation. They had a very compelling compensation schedule at their firm prior to our combination that balanced growth in the business along with performance. In fact, I would say there's a priority placed on performance at that firm. It was highly compatible with our own compensation schedules at this firm, so we left them unchanged. We thought they were compelling and had the Cortina team with a lot of skin in the game in terms of being motivated to continue to outperform. With regards to cash and stock, cash is primarily being used to buy out minority shareholders or others who are leaving the firm in time. Stock is more heavily weighted, or exclusively weighted, I should say, to the ongoing professionals at the firm who are responsible for their very good track record. In the earnout periods, which rewards them in the purchase agreement that has been filed publicly, there is a mix of cash and stock. Again, to the extent the outside shareholders are participating in that, they'll be getting the cash, and our new partners will be more heavily weighted towards stock. Stock ownership is very important at this firm. It makes us partners. It helps us all keep a long-term view and have skin in the game with regards to growth of the business.
Great. My final question relates to your core institutional business. Look back at the end of the year and you look forward, what are the common characteristics of the assets that you're winning, and what are the common characteristics of the assets that are leaving you?
So, we've had very, very few lost institutional business. We did lose an account in the fourth quarter. The nature of that was due to a merger. It was an organization that merged with another one and had a different process and stable of managers for its portfolio. lost assets in general over the past few years, which I've commented on prior calls, have primarily been for rebalancing purposes. We have not lost institutional business to speak of, so there isn't much to characterize. Rebalancing is just a matter of the asset allocation work that those institutions are undertaking, and as our capabilities outperform or otherwise rise beyond levels they're comfortable with, they take some of the winnings off the table. That's a high-class problem to have. With those that we are winning, what we tend to have are very high-quality consultant relationships. They are a wide variety of types of institutions, from pension funds to endowments to pools of assets that can grow because they're part of, an insurance company vehicle. Healthcare has been a significant one for us, but in general, it's being done through the consultants, and they span the different types of institutions that you can think of. Our largest, I think, is publicly known is CalSTRS. We have just a very wide variety. I think the key thing to look at is that we're working with intermediaries that we would consider partners and that they would as well. There's also the fact that Silvercrest is on the Morgan Stanley Smith Barney platform with its small cap capability and mid cap capability. That's been driving very meaningful flows to the business. Obviously, we seek to introduce other capabilities to that long-standing relationship.
Thank you for taking my questions.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star and then the number one key on your telephone keypad. And our next question comes from Brian Roman with Boston Partners. Your line is open.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning,
Brian. Hi, Brian.
Good morning. A bunch of questions. The decline sequentially in cash on the balance sheet. What's the reason for that?
So we pay out our annual compensation primarily in the month of February.
Got it. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
And so that'll build up substantially until next spring.
Right.
So you always have to normalize our cash for that.
Sure. That's what I thought. The Cortina acquisition, I'm sorry, I haven't seen the documents you filed on the purchase agreement. Have you disclosed the price, the breakdown between cash and stock, anything about their profitability, their margins? I think I looked on their website, their AUM was about $2.1 billion or some number like that. So anyway, what can you tell me at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the purchase agreement, there is nominal pricing on the deal and a mention of their pro forma run rate. We have not disclosed expected EBITDA or accretion or earnings. We are undergoing a consent process currently, we will be filing pro formas on the deal once we have closed, which will be targeted in July, which gives us half a year of their revenue contribution as well as EBITDA and any other accretion that may occur to earnings.
You've disclosed the price that you're paying.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I missed it. What was it? Was that the $40 million?
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Yep. At closing. Right.
At closing. That's correct.
And is there any back end to that price? Is there a piece that could be paid at a later date based on performance?
There are two pieces. Secondly, there's a piece paid in year two to get up to the upfront cost, and then there's an earnout which is paid out over the next few years, which is entirely dependent upon achieving growth.
And that
is also disclosed, yes.
Okay, so upfront $40 million, something in year two, something after a certain amount of years?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay. I think I got the $2.1 billion off of their website. Is that number close enough?
Close enough. It sounds a little high, but yeah, close enough.
Fine. I thought, yeah, 2.1 was okay.
I spoke in round numbers at two. You know, it's going to be high billions to low twos.
Fine.
But again, you know, we're not combining until July. Who knows what happens until then, right?
Sure. Your guess is as good as mine.
When you know, let me know, Brian.
Yeah. Yeah. After I've invested for myself, sure. and then I'll let you know.
Okay.
So, and any comment about their EBITDA margins and just it's really above industry, in line? Let me just ask, are their EBITDA margins what you would consider in line?
I think their EBITDA margins are very good for an institutional asset management firm. I think this has been a very, very prudently well-run company that has historically had high EBITDA margins. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Have you given the breakdown between cash and stock?
I'm trying to think if we have. Scott, do you know if we've given that up?
Yeah, at closing it's 80% cash, 20% stock.
Okay. So this is going to use up a big chunk of the cash sitting on the income on the balance sheet.
It'll use a fair bit. We're also we're doing some other things. But yes, it'll use a fair bit of cash.
So the cash balance, I think the cash balance should after closing will basically be the third quarter earnings report. Drop a healthy amount.
Yeah, we'll have a meaningful cash outflow at closing, and then of course even without Cortina, we're also building up cash, and then once they're on board, we'll have cash contribution from their earnings as well.
And finally, Brian, and Brian, I'll note. I think it's important just to note that Silvercrest currently has zero debt.
Yes. Okay. Last couple of questions. EBITDA margin in the quarter, adjusted EBITDA margin was 25. Fourth quarter, it was 34.6. All of last year, it was 30. What's a good number for 2019 without going too deep into projections?
I think I'm going to get pretty deep in the projections to give you a 2019, so I'm going to take a pass on that. Let me just give you some color though, because I do think it's helpful, and it's something I've talked about in the past. I think when we're running really well on all cylinders, we're going to be hovering around that 30% margin point. Of course, that's ex Cortina. That's as the company stands now. And dependent upon where we are in an investment cycle on behalf of personnel in the business, since I can't write off the hiring someone, it's a direct hit against EBITDA and our earnings, right? It's not like an acquisition, right? People are not machines. There's not a CapEx thing that I can do. So to the extent I invest in the business or do new things while we try to grow, I'm going to hit EBITDA. And it's possible we can cycle down as low as 22, 24 at times when we've done that. And if you look at the history of the company, going back over the past several years, we've definitely done that and then grown through it. I think a good number in a steady state, once you've done that, is around that 30 number. And then if some right things hit, like some of the fees we received in the fourth quarter for good performance, you can exceed it as we did. But that's going to be gravy on top. I think it will expand with good institutional business, given the high margins in that business. The decline to 25 that you're looking at now is really just a factor primarily of one quarter of you know, fixed costs against a decline in revenue, primarily due to the markets. So with regards to 2019, look, if you think about it, half the year is pretty much baked in because of March 31 being behind us. The good equity markets in March, the new business we see coming along should push us back towards that 30 number over the course of the year. Whether it happens for 2019 or is on a rolling one-year period, if all things being equal, things remain where they are, is something I can't predict. Again, we go back to the question of you investing your money in the market and then you telling me how it's going to do.
Yeah, no, we'll discuss that offline. That's the easy stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
Last question.
I hope that gives you the color you wanted.
Yes, it does. Last question is about fees. I did not do the calculation of average fees on the asset management business here. What was it? Are you feeling pressure? I guess Cortina is a higher fee, lower average fee. I'm mostly asking about direction here.
Yeah, no, nothing to comment on with regards to direction. The change in fees against discretionary assets did come down over the course of 2019, but it wasn't because of changing of fees for existing clients or lowering of fees for new clients. It was primarily
Rick, I want to clarify something you just said. It came down over the course of, and then you said 2019. Did you mean 18?
I meant 18. I'm so sorry.
Okay, fine.
I was looking at a sheet dated 19, but yes.
Sure.
But that was primarily a factor of equity selling off, which receive a higher fee than fixed income. So on balance, when you look at your discretionary assets, your fee comes down. It was not a matter of additional fee pressure, having to win new business at lower fees, or renegotiating fees on behalf of clients. So
okay.
It came down for those reasons. So, you know, I want to be clear and straightforward about that, but not for any other business considerations or long-term trends. We are hanging in with our fees where they have been a decade or more.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time, your question, your answers.
Thanks, Brian.
You're welcome, Brian. Always nice to talk to you.
Thank you. And I'm showing no further questions at this time. I would now like to turn the call back to your speakers for closing remarks.
Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate the questions and the time you spent with us to review the first quarter of 2019. As you can tell, we're quite enthusiastic about our new partners at Cortina joining the firm hopefully the beginning of the third quarter or somewhere around then of this year, as well as the other growth initiatives we're undertaking, whether it is now trying to aggressively grow the OCIO business, the new opportunities we have for institutional business, either with Cortina or our existing value equity team, and the hiring of additional portfolio managers to help us with high net worth organic growth. Thank you again for your time, and we look forward to speaking next quarter. Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This does conclude the program, and you may all disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.